your host today. Welcome, everyone. I'm honored to be your host today. My name is April J. Ford. I'm an author and speaker helping people to develop the right mindset for success and to increase their revenue stream based on a unique business model that I teach. The purpose of Journey to Success is to interview people who are making a difference in the world to help encourage and inspire others to do the same with their lives. So my guest today is Dr. John L. Turner. After graduating from Ohio State University with a degree in engineering physics, Dr. Turner continued in graduate school. 3 years into the PhD program, he was given a book about Edgar Cayce, the Sleeping Prophet. This changed the course of his life, and he was excited about the existence of a spiritual world and made immediate plans to attend Ohio State University's College of Medicine, where he earned his doctorate. Dr. Turner was the first neurosurgeon in Hawaii, and I had the privilege of meeting him just last year when we were both being interviewed about our books for a TV network. The title of his book is Medicine, Miracles, and Manifestations, A Doctor's Journey Through the Worlds of Divine Intervention, Near-Death Experiences, and Universal Energy. Medicine, Miracles, and Manifestations reveals how metaphysical events such as remote viewing, telepathy, consciousness, and life after death are demonstrations of the manner in which the human brain interfaces with the universal energy. Without further ado, welcome to Journey to Success, Dr. Turner. How are you today? Calling all the way from Hawaii.
Oh, hi, April. My pleasure to talk with you again, and always it's nice to talk to you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Dr. Turner. Can you believe it's been almost, gosh, I think it's almost been a year when we met, and I have your book right here that you gave me, you know, when we first met, and I highly, highly recommend this book for anyone looking to expand their spiritual growth and understanding.
Well, thank you, April. It's going to be fun to talk with you today.
So for the listeners out there, you know, who haven't yet read about your book, Dr. Turner, let's just start with the basics. Can you explain what are miracles?
Well, since I published that book 4 years ago, or since it was published by Career Press and New Page Books, now I'm at the point where I can fully see that every single thing around us is truly a miracle. And I have to admit, as I went through medical school and then neurosurgery and came to the Big Island of Hawaii, I was the first neurosurgeon on this island, not the first in Hawaii. The famous Dr. Ralph Cloward, known for anterior cervical fusion, was actually the first neurosurgeon in Hawaii. But at least I was able to come to the Big Island and provide a service. Well, after publishing the book, meeting people like you and many others, I have come to realize that what I took for granted was really totally miraculous. And even a thing like the shoulder joint is such a complex device, and it's just beyond words what it means. And as I made this journey, and I think you know now, April, I've come to realize that there is some type of a higher power, some type of a source of energy that is behind all of this. And maybe it's driven by a much more potent power, and that power is the one of love. So I will have to say, what is a miracle? Every single thing is a miracle, because none of it can be explained. We can't really create it ourselves. It's just beyond words. And I think that movie, John Travolta's movie, Phenomena, really sums it up, that everything is on its way somewhere, everything. And we have to respect everyone and everything, because everything is a miracle. So with that said, you know, what I used to think were manifestations of miracles, I've learned a lot. And coming from Brazil with a chance to be with John of God and see some real healing miracles, all I can say is that there is a spiritual world, there is an afterlife, and there's something that people have identified as a Holy Spirit that that wants us to heal and makes its presence known through what we call miracles. So I would say that the miraculous is something that you see around you that cannot be explained and can only be admired in awe. Kind of a long-winded explanation of a miracle, but that's the way I see it now, April.
Okay, great explanation, Dr. Turner. Now, would you say that manifestations can produce miracles?
Although the manifestation is part of the title of my book, Medicine, Miracles, and Manifestations, there was a time when I thought I could really learn how and practice manifesting things in my life and having things go the way I wanted them to go. And that's why I spent a year doing what Tina Turner probably still does and many others, is chanting Nam-myoho Renge Kyo, trying to produce these manifestations and miracles in your life. But as I changed and as I met the people who have studied this much more depth than I have, I realized that perhaps what we think we're doing when we manifest things or when we pray for things or whatever, we're following a path that's already set for us and predetermined before we came here to this earth, and we're just watching it unfold. And we may think we have some control and free will, but scientific studies don't support that. And it appears that we make decisions based on what we learn as an infant and up to the age 10, when the connections of our brain are really great in number, much more than we have as an adult. And then after that, the only thing left to really form is what is called the prefrontal cortex. And by teenage years, the 20s, that finally, maybe age 25, stops, and we're left with some circuits very firmly in place, that make our decisions for us, so to speak. So I have changed a little bit on what I thought was manifestation, and I realize what we're doing, at least what I think I'm doing, is following a predetermined path that was already laid out. And as I try to make things appear, things that I wanted to take place, these things are already going to happen anyway. So really there's not much to do but follow the path, try to help others as we go through this life, and to have a good time at the same time. So manifestation, I think, is becoming aware of something that's in your path and ready to become made apparent. And I think trying to manifest it is just trying to get a sneak peek at the future, kind of like a spontaneous remote viewing, if you will.
So I agree to an extent with your philosophy on that, Dr. Turner. I mean, I personally believe we do have free will based on, you know, my beliefs in God, but He, you know, being the source, has the ultimate, let's say, override of power, per se, to make corrective actions or course corrections. So to an extent, I do believe we have free will, but in certain situations, like you mentioned, that we are on a predetermined path, and it's determined by the one and only source.
Well, you know, these last few years I've spent talking with friends about this very issue of free will. And usually when we begin these talks, they're fairly adamant, as you are, about, yes, we have this free will. And my mother, bless her soul, who was a child psychologist, when I told her about the book I was writing and we talked about free will, and I told her the scientific studies, which we can talk about if you'd like, show that perhaps we don't have the free will we think we have. And she immediately came back to say, that's ridiculous. If we had no free will, people could do whatever they want and then blame it on the fact that it was supposed to happen. They had no control. Well, you have to realize by the time she said that, she was in her 90s, her late 90s. She had worked all her life with juvenile delinquents. So that's why she jumped on that. But the work of Dr. Benjamin Libet, for one, L-I-B-E-T is his name, he came up with a timing device, April, in which people could tell almost to the millisecond when they were going to initiate an action. And he began with a simple experiment. He said, "When I want you to move your thumb in towards your palm, and the minute you're going to make that move, I want you to note it on my timing device." Well, he also had them wired up to pick a signal from the brain he called the readiness potential, and he found that a third of a second before they said now to move their thumb, he was already picking up these signals from the brain showing that the thumb was going to be moved. Well, that suggests that we lag our conscious awareness by 1/3 of a second. Now, he did allow in his experiments a 200 millisecond window, 1/5 of a second, in which if we're really focused on top of things, we might be able to modify things that have already started and that are in progress. But I tell you, there's been a lot of research into this and to try to figure out what is consciousness, and that's the big thing. When we talk about conscious awareness, what is that? And does the brain produce our consciousness, or is it something more powerful than that? And I've come to realize, as many others have, that it's not the brain that produces our consciousness. It's our brain allows us to simply interact with this consciousness. And as long as we can keep our brains healthy, we can enjoy what there is to enjoy and function properly. But if we have a stroke, for example, that leaves us with some paralysis or visual loss or speech impediment, well, we've lost the ability to 100% interact with this consciousness. So we've just got to keep on top shape and try to avoid all the temptations to lapse in drugs, alcohol, and all of that. But I really think that as time goes by, April, when you go deeper into this, you'll find two things. You'll find that there is a source, as you said, that most people refer to as God or the higher power. But you may find that the control is already set before we come here, before we incarnate on this earth. We already have chosen the path. We've chosen the lessons we need to know. The slate is wiped clean, and we come here and we go through these lessons. And the only thing that maybe we can take with us to the next level is those lessons, what we've learned. And, you know, that's what I think about the free will. And I think it's good to be on top of things, not to miss that small 1/5 of a second window that we can try to make things a little bit more pleasant. But we're going to learn these lessons regardless. And we're going to keep repeating them until we get it down. That's what I think.
Right. I totally agree with the fact that you said, you know, life is about, you know, lessons that we're learning. We're here to experience the journey of life and to grow and learn. But let me just go back to this timing device that you mentioned. I'm interested in this timing device where, if I understand it correctly, it can basically track from the moment your brain has a thought and your physical body initiating the actual actions of a thought. So there's a 1/3 of a second gap between the thought and the action. Now, could our observations, is that correct? Am I correct?
Well, kind of. When I say timing device, this was before the advent of things like functional MRI scans, which can show, pinpoint what areas of the brain are lighting up. This was a device, a timing device, in which someone could say, at this moment, I'm going to do such and such, and the time could be recorded. Pretty close, within milliseconds, to when the person said, now I'm going to, like, move the thumb. But, as I said, 1/3 of a second before that very instant, he was already picking up the signal showing that their thumb was going to be in motion. That's what I mean by the timing device.
Oh, okay.
Now,
okay.
This has been substantiated by a functional MRI scanning showing that there are areas of the brain that are lighting up before our conscious awareness is going to produce a voluntary movement. So, I mean, it's all of interest to those who study consciousness and the mind and things like that, but what practical good is it? It only means that if we want to try to make our learning situations not too unpleasant, we might be able to make a modification at the very onset of something if we're really focused. But it's only 1/5 of a second, and it's not much time. And it's easy to miss those 1/5 of a second, 2/2 of a second. So that's kind of what I meant by all that, April.
Okay. So going back 4 years ago when you were writing your book, Medicine, Miracles, and Manifestations, what made you pursue other methods of healing that were, you know, I'd say they weren't viewed as conventional. These were pretty unconventional methods, would you say, coming from a medical background?
Coming from a Western medical background, yes. You know, energy healing, things like Reiki and which is using what people call the universal energy, because there is an energy in every cubic millimeter of space or vacuum everywhere. There's this constant particles are appearing and annihilating each other in a burst of energy, and this is what people call free energy. And the people who practice healing, like with Reiki, feel they can tap into this energy. I worked with that and also with something called Jorei, in Japanese means uplifting of the spirit. And this has to do with the channeling of a spiritual light energy from the palm of the hand. And what led me to that was really my patients, who at times gave me various books on subjects that they knew I would like. So they introduced me to the fact that all of the cells of our body emit light in not only the visible range, but the ultraviolet range. Well, we don't see people walking around lighting up, but detectors called single photon detectors that the astronomers now have access to, it's been shown in technical papers that all the cells of the body emit light, but most of the light is emitted from the fingertips, in particular the fingernails, and this can be picked up as visible light. Well, this type of healing using that type of thing has to do with the spiritual cords linking to someone who was enlightened to the point where he received a spear of light in his abdomen. And in my book, I discuss how I came across this man named Mokichi Okada, born in 1882, but died in 1955. But he, in his enlightenment, was blessed with this spear of light. He said it's a gift from God, and he was healing people, not only people he touched, but people that he didn't touch. But from a distance, he would let this energy just flow from his hand. And then the metaphysical part really comes in when he said, look, I have enough light for a million people. It's not just me. If I write the symbol for light in Japanese, which is hikari, it's called light, and give this to a person, it ties them with the spiritual cord, and they can direct light energy from their hand coming from him. He died in 1955, but in 50 countries, over 50 countries, he still practices teaching about healing like this, the eating of natural food, and the appreciation of art and beauty. So I was kind of destined to get into this type of healing and things ever since that book about Edgar Cayce was given to me when I was in graduate school in physics, and I, like you mentioned, I completely changed and decided to go from PhD in physics to an MD because I wanted to go into psychiatry to study the mind. But before I knew how it worked, my plan wasn't going to be that. It was always for me to be a brain surgeon, to study the brain, and to help people heal. So I'm sorry for the long-winded explanation, but that's how into these things.
Well, I'm glad you touched on the topic of, and I hope I'm pronouncing it right, Jorei. That was one of my favorite stories in your book about the young boy named Daryl, and as you were just recalling what the processes of transferring energy, I recall that picture that you had where you're basically in the operating room where Daryl was on the table, and you had your hand basically placed over Daryl's head performing Jorei, and if I can explain that pronounce it correctly. Can you explain a little bit more of that story, Dr. Turner, with Daryl? And I'm glad that you talked about Okada's energy. I mean, this was one of my favorites because I remember that story clearly because Daryl gave you a signal, 143, which represented the code. And to me personally, I knew what that meant because my late husband and I used to use that internal code too between our communication.
Well, I'll briefly tell that story because the chapter is called Called to Say I Love You. That's the title. And let me say this. This happened many years ago, but I just saw this young man in Las Vegas 3 weeks ago. I was there for a conference on ultrasound scanning of the shoulder, the knee, and the hip. And he stopped by to pick me up and just drive around one afternoon. It was hot. You know, the heat was 106 degrees over there, so
yeah,
quite different than Hawaii. But here's this young man that at one time had been essentially pronounced dead. And what happened was this. One day as I parked my car to go to surgery in the morning, an anesthesiologist parked next to me. And as we walked to the hospital, he said, well, did you see the boy with the gunshot wound? I said, well, I don't know what you're talking about. You know, Sunday, yesterday, nobody called me. He said, well, he's up there in the ICU, and they've taken him off the respirator, and his head's all wrapped in disposable paper towels. And I said, gee, I'm sorry to hear that. But so I went, I did my surgical case, and when I got out of it, my beeper went off for the ICU. And sure enough, they wanted me to see this young man. His mother had remembered that I had seen him twice before, once for his back and once for a laceration on his eyebrow. And she just wanted me to know what the situation was, that He was brought in the day before with a self-inflicted gunshot wound to his head, and they said there was just no way anything could be done, and they wanted her to consent. They could harvest his kidneys, his eyes, you know, his lungs, and so forth. But his girlfriend at the time remembered that he had mentioned that he never wanted to be an organ donor, so the mother had to refuse. So when I looked at the scan, I picked it up and took it up to the ICU, I could see all these bullet fragments, a hole in his head, and it just looked bad. And when I walked into the room, the mother was there, the girlfriend, and the girlfriend was sobbing, and here he was in the bed with an endotracheal tube, that's what they put in for breathing, coming out of his mouth, but no machine breathing and just taking an occasional shallow breath. And the mother explained that they were just waiting for him to take that last breath since nothing could be done. So, you know, I took her outside privately and I put up the scan on the view box and I said, ma'am, I hate to say this, but, you know, my understanding is he was seen by the neurologist. They called neurosurgeons in Honolulu and they said nothing can be done. And I said, even if he could make it through something like this, he may never move his left arm or leg again. I said, would he want to live like that? And she said, no, absolutely not. I said, well, I'm really sorry to hear this. And then she made a life-saving statement. She said, but Dr. Turner said, he responds to me. I said, what do you mean, responds to you? She said, well, he'll squeeze my hand. So the whole picture changed. I couldn't believe what I was hearing. I said, no, wait just a minute. This is far from someone being pronounced dead. So I went back in, and I put, you know the story, I put my fingers in his hand, and you couldn't see him move, but I whispered in his ear, I said, Darryl, this is Dr. Turner. I said, squeeze my fingers, and I could feel him tighten up. Couldn't see it, but I could feel it. And I said, now let go, and he did. I said, squeeze again. He did, and he let go. And I said, this changed the whole picture. I got him to be able to slowly wiggle those fingers so you could see the movement. And I told him what happened. He said he couldn't remember any of that, but he did tell me he wanted to live. And then he said the 1-4-3, meaning I love you. Make a long story short, yes, I took him right to the operating room. I cleaned up all this thing, fixed the hole in the skull and all that stuff. And then, being that this is Hilo, and they knew I was studying this effects of Joray and healing with my patients, I was able to sit there and give him this Joray from the palm of my hand from a distance of about a foot from his head for 45 minutes in the operating room. And I think any other operating room in the country, they would have called me out of there and pulled me out of there to say, you must be out of your mind. What are you doing? But this is Hawaii, number one. Number two, I was the only neurosurgeon on the island, so they weren't going to tell me, "Don't you can't do this and that." And plus, they wanted to know. They had seen some kind of miracles happen. And I kept the boy in a coma for the first 4 days after the surgery purposely to let the brain swelling go down. But by the end of 2 weeks, he was singing to the nurses. They transferred him to rehab. And then he made a spectacular recovery. He still had weakness of that left arm. But 8 years later, my wife said, there's a man walking up the driveway. We have a long 600-foot driveway. And it was this young boy, Darryl, was his name, Darryl Ueno. And he had found out where I lived because he wanted to thank me. It was 8 years to the date from his surgery, and he wanted to invite me to his wedding. And now they have a little girl, a daughter, who is 8 years old, and I got to see her last month in Las Vegas. And it's just amazing to be able to sit and talk with this boy. But one thing he remembered, that day I pulled into the doctor's parking lot, he was at the window, out of his body, watching me park that car and hoping, praying actually, he said, that I would come and save him. So the whole story is really interesting, but it is a moving story with that I love you, because love is the power that makes it all work, and I think he was never dead. It's just no one seemed to care enough to really try to examine him carefully, because, you know, it looked terrible with a, you know, brain material all over his head and a big hole and all that, and he couldn't move anything, obviously, but his mother saved his life. When she made that remark, he responds to me, and that's the love.
Now, which methods or stories, obviously, like I said, I love that story of Darryl. Which methods or stories from your book are your favorite and why? I mean, out of soul travel, astral projection, remote viewing, or Joray, which would you say is one that you've come to prefer?
You know, April, my friend, it's so hard because I picked the ones that made a lot to me. the one about the woman who saw an angel in the light the morning of her death, or, you know, the morning of her catastrophe with the brain hemorrhage, that was significant. But the very first story I opened the book with shows that, as my friend Bill Sweet, who wrote a book called A Journey into Prayer, in which he scientifically studied with a father and son team named Klingbeil, as Christian scientists, they studied scientifically how does prayer work. And it was a case where, you know, I thought it was going smoothly. I had removed all but one piece of a brain tumor. And as I told my assistant, we're looking in a microscope, I said, look, there's one last piece and we're out of here. And as soon as I grabbed that piece out with the instruments, it turned bright red. And for the next 4 hours, another 4 hours, everything I did to stop the bleeding failed. Everything. I tried to suture up the rent that was in the artery where that last tumor had grown into the carotid artery. I tried to use small clips. Nothing would stop the bleeding. And we replaced the woman's entire blood volume, which is not a good thing. You know, it can cause bleeding all over the body. And I remember that day so clear, like it was yesterday or this morning. I stopped and I said to myself and out there, I put this thought, if there is a higher power, I need help. I can't do it. And it's not this woman's fault. She came to me for help. And I tried to be a cowboy getting that last tiny piece, and look what's happened. I said, so I need help, and I need this bleeding to stop now. Well, I asked for a suture again, the same thing I'd done for the last 4 hours, a couple clips. And a few minutes later, I asked my assistant to relieve the pressure and let this area flow, the blood, and sure enough, it was bone dry. Amazing. Wow. And I realized the woman was going to make it out of the operating room. Then I've learned that this is called goal-directed prayer, very specific. You want this to happen, no ifs, ands, or buts, this is what you want. And they tested that with soybeans, in which people prayed over the soybeans, saying, I want you to grow straight and tall and thick and the yellow color and all that. And these beans did better than a control group that had no prayers.
Wow.
Well, then Bill
Sweet
found that, yeah, he found that if people of all denominations came in and prayed over another control group and said, I want you to grow and to grow in the best possible way, they did better than that goal-directed group in which they specifically said, I want you to be thick and tall and green and all that. Well, that's what I did. I said, wait a minute. I had a link now to some higher power, and I said, wait, I'm not through. As a result of this business, this lady could end up on a respirator, being unable to breathe. She could be stroked out and eyes all crossed and crippled. I said, look, if you let her come out of this the best possible way, I'll be the best possible person that I can be. Well, that's the non-goal-directed prayer. You know, I just took everything out of it and said, you know, here, let her have the power and let this be the best way for everyone concerned. And that's what happened. She came through that with only a slight droop of her eye. She gave me a plaque that says basically Heiwa in Japanese. And I found out later as I put that on the wall in my exam room that it means peace. And I thought finally I had found that there is this higher power and there's a way to connect to it. Unfortunately, as that first chapter in my book concludes with the second case of a young girl who died kind of inexplicably after surgery, I began to wonder, what is really going on? I thought I had a wired to this higher power. Well, then it took the next 30 years before I really came to where I am at now with everything and realized that there is indeed a higher power, but it's something much more deep. And did I not mention to you, April, the book called 47 Billion Years of Evolution, in which two doctors from Honolulu asked me to write a foreword to their book. And okay. I agreed to do it because I knew the subject matter, April, because I had read a book before of theirs called Bridging Two Worlds, in which they explain how the group of people would come together in a darkened room that they called the Dark Room Sessions. And they began first experimenting with the Ouija board like a lot of people do. Then they moved into channeling, and they felt that wasn't very accurate. And then they expressed the desire to see spirits materialize before their eyes. Well, it took a few years, but it began to happen. And then over the next 15 years or so, one particular spirit would materialize. And in the center of the room, out of a wisp of smoke, they would begin to see a figure crouching down, kneeling, that would stand up to be 7 feet tall.
Wow.
And they got permission to take a picture, April, and I have that picture. And the skin of this individual that he said he chose so he could have a human form was as black as coal. His hair was curly and black as coal. And his name was Anika, and he had a British accent. And he did primarily most of the teaching that came out in this book, 47 Billion Years of Evolution. And it took me 3 months to write a two-page foreword, which you can read at Amazon by clicking on Look in the Book. And
okay.
You can see, it may sound a little cryptic, but it was a difficult thing for me to write because, look, if you ask a cosmologist or astronomer, how old is this universe, they can tell you. We know it's 13.77 billion years old. But this title, 47 billion years, I had to try to get around it. So it took a lot of study into paleoarchaeology and cosmology. But when I finished this book, writing the foreword, I had the answer to the elusive third part of the question. The first part I had answered, why are we here? Second part, where do we go when we leave here? What happens to our soul, our consciousness? I thought I had that down. But I didn't understand how this universe came into existence because, April, as a physicist, I know it can be shown that all of this came from nothing. Now, what I mean by that is not even initial energy. And I was stumped. I couldn't really understand this until this black spirit basically taught these people it comes from a source that you people call God, but it's the ultimate source, the highest power. But this source needs to also feed life throughout this universe. And there are not too many places where it can do that, but it has to give it enough free will that it can evolve, and then it has to check in to see the progress for its own spiritual growth. So this source is an energy that can create energy. And I would really recommend just reading that two-page foreword and see if it makes any sense to you. Because with that, I stopped all of my research in the spiritual world. And when you asked me to be on the show, you know, you're such a great person. I wanted to do this for you, but this is the end of my work, and I'm going to devote all my energy now into helping other people in doing what I was here to do. As a doctor, I think I can help people through their suffering and their pain. So that's what I do now.
Wow, and that's what I was curious about, Dr. Turner. What made you basically halt all of your research? I mean, all these stories and lies that you've impacted in your book, and, you know, it took a lot of time and understanding of different...
It happened in St. Louis, April, when I met you.
Right.
It wasn't meeting you that did it, but it was at the same time, and I think I mentioned this, and I've talked to people recently about it. It was the same time a gentleman I met, a neurosurgeon named Evan Alexander, had published a book called Proof of Heaven. And I met him the year before when he was thinking about writing a book about his experience when he was in a coma for a week. Well, when the book Proof of Heaven came out and became an overnight bestseller, it changed me. I realized that I was on the wrong path trying to promote my book, to think about writing book and doing research, when really I just wanted to answer those questions. Why are we here? What is our purpose? Where do we go? What happens when we die? And how did this all come into being? So when I decided, and I got back from St. Louis after meeting you and the people there doing the TV thing, I came back, I doubled my office work, you know, I was had it easy, you know, doing consulting, but I increased that so I could be more available to patients. But yet, I wasn't able to fix anything. I had stopped operating, neurosurgically speaking, you know, because I put in so many years, so many marriages and divorces that finally I was at a point where I could just do consulting. But then a friend of mine said to me one day, April, he said, what are you doing now over there in Hilo? I said, well, I'm doing consulting work, and I can help people with pain. You know, some people need medications, and I can do that. He said, how much do you make? I said, you know what, I really don't know, which was true. I don't make very much money doing this because workers' comp and auto accidents don't pay very much, and most medical doctors won't get involved. But when my mother passed, they called me, the chiropractor, and they said, can you help us? We need an MD to work with us. And I said, sure, I can help you out, because my mother lived to 99 because she always took time to help others, right? So, April, what happened was he said to me, well, why don't you do what I've been doing 10 years? you know, do these nerve blocks using an ultrasound machine, you can stop their pain without having to use medications and narcotics. And it just so happened when he came to talk to me about it, to Hilo, the one doctor who we could send patients to for spinal injections and all that, suddenly quit business. You know, he must have had some medical problem and he just closed his doors. So it looked like I was supposed to do it, so it led up to me buying that machine. When I finally reached the point where I had no debts, no anything, no problems at all, but I realized by doing this I can help even more people. And it's all about service to others, April. It's not about selling books or trying to be famous or any of that stuff. It's simply about doing what we're here to do, and in my case, it was being a physician and using my knowledge to help people.
Now, would you say that if opportunity presented itself or if you're in a situation to help somebody else, would you resort to using any of these methods that you've learned?
Well, I still do that. I've always stayed doing the Jure and also the Reiki, but now I've kind of moved to a more technical thing with the advent of these ultrasound machines, which aren't that expensive. They cost about $30,000-$40,000. But with it, you can scan the shoulder, the knee joints, everything, and you can find nerves that you can treat. And it gets so technical. There are things that are so new that probably no one else in Hawaii does it. It's called pulsed radio frequency neuromodulation. You can heat up a nerve to 40 degrees centigrade, which is not enough to hurt the nerve or damage it, but it reprograms the nerve to stop sending the pain signal. So
oh, wow.
These kind of things are cutting-edge things, and they're helping people, and that's what I do. So, and then I have people come to the clinic, the Japanese clinic, which we still hold twice a month, and where they can experience the flower arranging, the tea ceremony, and then receive this jure, this type of healing. And almost everyone that comes decides they want to learn how to do it too, just like I did, and they can do it. And anyone can put this into practice. So, yes, I do use this in healing, and I think I always will do whatever it takes to holistically treat the patient, which is a blend of Eastern and Western medicine.
That's amazing, Dr. Turner. So before we close, if you could just summarize what you have learned about, you know, life at this point, what would you want to tell our listeners out there about life, death, and life after death?
I would say that it's really kind of simple, that we come, and the cover of my book shows a dandelion flower, right, and the process getting ready to blow those seeds out to all regrow again. And this is the way it is. We have to perfect our spirit. We've got to go through lessons. My lesson this time, I know what it was. It was to learn forgiveness and how to really 100% give forgiveness. And when I finally reached that point, I was able to forgive those who had harmed me. I had already asked for forgiveness for those I had harmed. But when I really was able to forgive those who put me through the horrendous things, I realized that I have to love them for what they did. If they hadn't put me through it, how could I learn forgiveness? Somebody had to agree to play the bad guy. And I think we do this when we come here after being in part of a soul family. We get together in some spiritual world and we decide, well, what's the next step? What do we have to do so we can perfect our spirits to the point where we can go back to that source from which we came, which basically is some type of an energy that can also create energy, right? So I've learned that we're all brothers and sisters, regardless of race, creed, color, and all that stuff. You know, we're all the same. We're in this boat together, and we've got to help each other through it. And as long as we do that, we can also have a good time, because there's a lot here to enjoy, April. But it's a never-ending story. Consciousness outlives the death of the physical body. And for that reason, Dr. Alexander's book is great, because he's made millions of people wake up to realize there is something after death of the physical body, and this may lead them to study deeper and deeper and conclude that we're all one. That's what I've learned.
Great. I love that summary, Dr. Turner. I totally agree that we're all here to, at the end of the day, basically serve one another, and talking on the topic of forgiveness, not only forgiving others, but I think a lot of people forget to forgive themselves. That's another point that I wanted to add. So in closing, Dr. Turner, again, I appreciate your time on Journey to Success. If you could tell the listeners your website, and if you could direct them to any download offers or any other closing remarks that you'd like to leave with.
All right. The Well, yes. Like I said, my purpose wasn't really to sell books, but there is something at the website, which is johnlturner.com. If someone registers for that website, they'll see a new link appear at the left that says Downloads. And there are two audio programs that I produced years ago using the HemiSync machine, which was designed by Robert Monroe, who designed the machine because he thought it would promote, you know, someone's ability to learn astral projection. But what it did, it enhanced healing, memory, and other things. So we used this when we made this relaxation tape. It's called Brain Sounds of the Pacific, and there are two different versions that can be downloaded, certainly no charge for this. I think people have some fun learning how to relax and how to be focused with this HemiSync signal. So that's the website, johnlturner.com, and you can read about the book and about my life and about some interesting things that will be of interest to anyone that stops by.
Great. Thank you. All righty, Journey to Success listeners, that's our show for today with Dr. John L. Turner. Until next time, I'm April J. Ford. Bye for now.